From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
The Dobbs opinion, in some ways, is one of the greatest transfers of power away from a branch, maybe since the Congress gave away a lot of its power over the welfare system in the 90s.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Dr. Adam Carrington, Associate Professor of Politics at Hillsdale College. Find him on Twitter at CarringtonAM. We talk in depth with Dr. Carrington today about an essay he recently wrote defending the Supreme Court from attacks coming from the left. Dr. Carrington, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.
Talking about a piece you wrote a little bit back for The Spectator, which is at thespectator.com, headlined, "No, the Supreme Court isn't democratic." And there's really two claims that you respond to in the piece. One is the undemocratic, and the second is this claim of judicial activism of the current court. Let's ask about that one first. What do critics mean when they accuse this court of judicial activism?
Well, fundamentally, judicial activism is, first and foremost, legislating while being part of the non-legislative branch, the judicial branch. And the question, therefore, being, did in the particular action they took, did they make law? And but here, so here the argument is either that they're making law in the actions that they've been taking, and they're particularly thinking of the new court with the six Republican-appointed nominees once Justice Barrett was added. The other is the claim that being activists is not merely legislating when you shouldn't be as a judge, but undoing precedent. Precedent being the previous decisions and especially long-standing opinions of the court, so especially the overturning of Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. And so those are the basis of those two actions, either that they're making law or that they're unmaking long-standing precedents and therefore engaging in a kind of activity above and beyond what these judges should be doing if they're staying in their lane, both related to other branches and related to the history of their own branch as far as what past judges have done.
Now, if we look at recent terms, and most specifically the most recent term of the court, would you say, though, the court is actually in ways pulling back on its power as opposed to trying to expand its power?
It's done both, and the way it has not expanded its power is not getting proper attention or is being misconstrued as doing the opposite. So yes, it is pulling back its power on issues like abortion, because the fundamental result of the Dobbs decision was to get the judicial branch mostly out of that question and return it to the states, return it to the legislative and lawmaking branches across the country and in D.C. And I would even say on things, if you go further back in the last 10 to 12 years, redistricting, the court has been very involved in redistricting. It's pulled back on that, voting rights and other things. But I would say there are some ways that it has said that it's going to take a more active role on things like the Second Amendment. It said the court has been too deferential on protecting Second Amendment rights. I'd say one more is on the administrative state, where the court in the past has been very permissive of just letting bureaucrats do their thing and saying that there's a problem with that. So I think the real issue isn't how much or how little they're doing, but what is a legitimate exercise of power. And I think they are reconfiguring that they think they have been too active in some areas, the first ones I said, and not active enough, not based on some objective standard of how much action is too much action, but what's the right kind of action for the judicial branch.
Right. If critics say that they are acting as activists, writing new law, so to speak, could it be argued the court is simply enforcing existing law, in some ways just enforcing the Constitution?
Right. And that's a thing that people need to think about when they think of the court voiding or striking down laws. The essence of that is that the court is to interpret and apply laws to figure out or conclude disputes about the law between Smith versus Jones or the state of Missouri versus the United States government or something like that. And the question there is, when they are striking down a law or voiding a law, they're merely saying it doesn't conform to the Constitution, and we are required to uphold the Constitution above any other law. And so the real question should be, is what should the judicial branch be doing, interpreting and applying the law? And are there instances where they are finding problems with the regular laws of the states or the regular laws of Congress that they shouldn't? That's where it would be activists. Mm-hmm. And are there instances where they're actually not enforcing the Constitution against violations of it? That's the real question that should be asked. And you, I think you can argue that even when they're being more active in, say, Second Amendment or the administrative state, that could be as a way of enforcing constitutional rights and restrictions, versus the ways they're getting out are where the court was illegitimately stepping in where the Constitution didn't allow it to be. So I think the court, in some ways, that shows that the court is being more nuanced. Mm-hmm. They're asking a bigger, more fundamental question of what should we be doing and what we should not be doing, rather than some arbitrary standard of how much is enough activity or inactivity.
If we go back just a few more years, is there perhaps a better argument that the court was involved in activism in, say, the Obamacare decision, in which Justice Roberts is writing and sort of reinterpreting, rewriting, some would say, the law to make it legal?
That's a very interesting debate among those justices, because Roberts claims he's being against judicial activism. He's being a judicial restraintist. That's sort of supposed to be the opposite of that, because he did everything he could to not strike a law down. And what the dissenters on that question said, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, Justice Kennedy, is they said, no, you're engaging in a more fundamental kind of activism, because to do that, you rewrote the law.
Mm-hmm.
Rewrote the law to say something it really didn't in order to uphold it. And rewriting a law is more fundamentally an act of judicial legislating and activism, therefore, than striking down a law as it was written. So I think, yes, I think they have the better point in that argument, in saying what is the essence of judicial activism? It isn't how many laws you strike down or uphold. It's, are you treating the law as it was written and treating it as subject to the Constitution?
Talking with Dr. Adam Carrington, his piece at The Spectator. No, the Supreme Court isn't undemocratic. Let's talk about that second claim, the claim in the headline. What do critics mean when they say the court is being undemocratic?
On one level, they mean that they're striking down laws, and that those laws were passed by the people, so that it's undemocratic. But really, that has gotten, especially lately, played second fiddle to the claim that these precedents that are being overturned or these laws that are being struck down are perceived as popular, usually based on polling or popular opinion. And I would say, just in contrast to that, the problem is that our constitutional system doesn't measure popular rule by public opinion polls.
Right.
The public expresses its opinion through its elected representatives in the act of lawmaking. And so the idea that you could put public opinion to polls above the law itself, I think, is a misunderstanding of how popular government works. But that's the essence of the accusation, is that they're not following what is perceived as the popular opinion through polling and things like that.
Has there ever really been a historical understanding that opinions from the Supreme Court should be popular, first and foremost?
Not in such a brazen way. I think there are people that have tried to make that, and still try to make that argument, in a more subtle way. Mm-hmm. And the subtle way is this concept of a living constitution. The idea that the Constitution's meaning is not set in stone, but is meant to evolve with the times. Well, how do you figure out how it evolves with the times? Often people trying to make that argument of that kind of reading of the Constitution look to changes in what is at least the perceived opinion of the people. Probably the worst example of this is with cruel and unusual punishment in the Eighth Amendment, where there was a standard for a long time, I think the court has largely scuttled this in the last few years, of what's called evolving standards of decency. the idea that they're evolving, so changing standards of what it means to treat human beings with decency. And those are often still measured by changes in laws, but that it becomes a way of perceiving where the public is as a way of then interpreting the Constitution, whereas I think it should really be the other way around.
If we look at some of the more recent decisions, Dr. Carrington, the story here can be one of returning power to the people in the Dobbs decision, giving power back to the people, the states to decide. In the West Virginia case, taking power away from bureaucrats, handing it back to Congress, who are accountable to the people. In ways, this is a more democratic court, right?
I think that and I think the way to look at those two is the Dobbs opinion in some ways is one of the greatest transfers of power away from a branch.
Mm-hmm.
Since maybe, well, this wouldn't be branches, this would be federalism, but maybe since a Congress gave away a lot of its power over the welfare system in the 90s, that's almost maybe the only comparable transfer of a institution giving away its own power. And you're right that where the courts, at least with West Virginia, what the courts are really maybe not so much giving up their own power there, but demanding that power be given back to the people from the bureaucrats themselves. Because the problem with West Virginia versus EPA that you were talking about was that the courts were that bureaucrats were making too many legislative decisions. Mm-hmm. And the court has said, no, the people need to be making these. So in that, the court isn't even trying to tell what environmental policy should be. That would be a legislative overreach. They're merely saying the right people need to be making those decisions. They aren't necessarily transferring power away from themselves, but they're saying no, they're still reaffirming the basic principle that the people need to have more power than they have under the earlier precedents.
Final question for Dr. Adam Carrington. Now, these accusations of being undemocratic or of trafficking in judicial activism, have there been eras in the court's history when these accusations would be true or truer than they are right now?
They've certainly been accused many times. So during the progressive era or what's called the Lochner era of the court, there were those accusations. I think those are a bit overblown. It would take some time to unpack that, but I think that's overstated. But I think a much clearer example would be the Warren Court in the 1950s. Through the late 1960s, even early 1970s, which was technically after Chief Justice Earl Warren, who the era is named after, was off the court. But I think on there, you really see on stuff like abortion, privacy issues, redistricting, a number of other things, the court massively expanding its own power against the other branches, mm-hmm. in ways that I think put its foot into places and used interpretations that went beyond what the normal constitutional role of a judiciary should be.
Dr. Adam Carrington, Associate Professor of Politics at Hillsdale College. Find his piece at thespectator.com. No, the Supreme Court isn't democratic. You can also follow him on Twitter at CarringtonAM and find all he writes. Dr. Carrington, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Up next, we're joined by Mark Hemingway, senior writer at Real Clear Investigations, about the number of armed federal employees. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Coming soon on The Larry Arn Show, psychiatrist, writer, and literary scholar Ian McGilchrist.
You are such an interesting man, living off on an island off Scotland, but I think that your books amount to a campaign to make us use the rest of our brain.
It's very interesting because, of course, I would never think of them as like that, and they're not intended in that way. I am, I suppose, pleased, but I'm very accepting of whatever happens. Generally, I think it's a sensible way to look at life. But I have been noticing that more and more people in more and more areas are referring to my work and finding it relevant. And I'm very pleased by that, as by the response of readers, which is endlessly touching.
Don't miss this conversation between Ian McGilchrist and Hillsdale College president Larry Arn. Subscribe now to The Larry Arn Show at podcast.hillsdale.edu/subscribe. That's podcast.hillsdale.edu/subscribe.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. For information on Hillsdale College for prospective students, for alumni or friends of Hillsdale, head to hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Mark Hemingway. He is senior writer at Real Clear Investigations. Find their work at realclearinvestigations.com. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote a piece a little bit ago over at Real Clear Investigations, Armed and Beltway-ish, More Federal Bureaucrats Than U.S. Marines Are Authorized to Pack Heat, as it says in the headline there. Why should we be alarmed by this?
Well, for one thing, we have this situation here where we have the federal government basically promulgating all of these rules from executive agencies, right? This is a situation where there's a lot of constitutional debate over this. Should these people be allowed to have what is essentially de facto legislative authority through all the rulemaking that they do? And at the same time, we have a situation where we have, unelected bureaucrats going out and passing their own laws. The number of federal employees that are armed and part of law enforcement services within these own agencies has been skyrocketing in the last couple of days. So we have a situation here where we have federal employees that basically get to pass their own laws, even though they're not democratically elected. And then they get to go out and enforce them at the point of a gun. Obviously this is, raises all kinds of questions about, to what extent this is, might be legitimately, unjust or tyrannical.
If you begin to read through the piece at Real Clear Investigations, you see the different agencies that have this authority, Health and Human Services and NASA and the EPA. It's far and wide. When you look at the actual numbers, what are we talking about in terms of the number of people and how does it compare to our number of U.S. Marines?
Right. Well, there are watchdog report by a group called Open the Books. Did a report on this, and they found that more than 200,000 federal bureaucrats have now been, granted law enforcement authority to carry guns and make arrests. And to put that in perspective, again, there are about 186,000 Marines that are serving on active duty right now. It's really, crazy. We have 103 executive agencies that are not part of the Department of Defense, more traditional law enforcement agencies as we understand them, that, spent $2.7 billion on guns, ammunition, and other, military equipment between 2006 and 2019. It's, increasing at a rapid pace. $1 million was spent just in the 4 years between 2015 and 2019. Pretty crazy, and it raises all kinds of questions about, what kind of training our federal bureaucrats get. Oftentimes these people aren't, like I said, they don't come up through the ranks of traditional law enforcement in the military. They just, end up in a federal agency and someone hands a gun to them. I don't think it's that simple, obviously. In fact, there's an entire federal agency right now that's dedicated to offering, firearms training and things like that to this growing number of people. But, again, it's not the same thing as, you get when you are part of a traditional law enforcement agency.
Mark, do we know about any sort of tracking or monitoring that is going on that would follow any incidents of use of force by these governmental agencies?
Well, and as far as I can tell, no one is doing anything of that sort. And on top of that, I can tell you from having reported on this, getting information directly out of the agencies about what they're doing in this regard is like pulling teeth. Well, frankly, I'll tell you as a reporter, getting any agency out of any executive agency anymore is like pulling teeth. But this in particular is obviously something where, they're circling the wagons around, when you look at what's going on here, there was a lot of talk, for instance, about when Congress recently passed, I think it was part of the Inflation Reduction Act, where they rapidly expanded the size of the IRS, and there are a number of, armed IRS, agents and stuff like that. The IRS is an interesting agency because, unlike most of these agencies that have just gotten, that have just gotten authority to carry guns in the last 25 years or so, the IRS has had, you know, basically, you know, federal law enforcement authority since basically it was created. So, you know, there are all kinds of weird little historical reasons and justifications for why these agents, for why some of these agencies have authority. In some cases, like the EPA, Congress directly, you know, granted them, you know, law enforcement powers, you know, in the 1980s. You know, whether or not you think that's a good decision or not, there was at least some sort of, like, you know, democratic element of it. Whereas, and like I said, that was true when IRS was created, you know, nearly 100 years ago. But most of this authority has been happening because of a single piece of legislation that was passed in the wake of 9/11 that just everyone interpreted that basically that, you know, anyone with an inspector general's office in their agency gets to go off and, you know, carry guns and enforce their own regulations. And that is something that is both new, has led to a dramatic increase in armed federal agents, and it's something that has not been scrutinized or really, you know, overseen. And so, you know, I think we really need to take sort of a holistic look at this. You know, maybe there are some federal agencies that, for whatever historical reasons, you know, the IRS, you know, worked hand in glove with the FBI and was responsible for helping bring down Al Capone, for crying out loud. You know, maybe there are reasons for a select number of IRS agents to be armed so that they can work directly with the FBI in operations. Maybe there are rational reasons for this, but these things need to be, you know, democratically explained. They need to be codified in law and not just, like, promulgated through, you know, regulations or otherwise just a result of, you know, one haphazard law that was put out there, which seems to be the case.
Mark Hemingway with us. His piece at Real Clear Investigations, Armed and Beltway-ish, More Federal Bureaucrats Than U.S. Marines Authorized to Pack Heat. As you mentioned, you talked to some of these organizations, or at least attempted to in many cases. Were they able to give you reasons for the use of weapons or the possible use of weapons? What's the purpose? What's the reason that they need this firepower?
Well, actually, one of the few agencies that did talk to me was a group called the Railroad Retirement Board, which is this incredibly obscure, you know, federal agency that manages pensions with regard to railroads. And, you know, they pointed out they have an inspector general's office that, you know, they manage pension funds, which, even for something as obscure as the Railroad Retirement Board, is, you know, a ton of money. And, you know, when you get involved in pension funds and, you know, a group like, you know, Railroad Retirement Boards, I don't know to what extent unions are involved in the railroad business or whatever. But, you know, they said that, look, there's a lot of fraud and we do a lot of investigations at the Inspector General's office, and that's why we've done. And, you know, it's a surface level explanation. I don't know, like I said, that might make some sense. But on the other hand, like, why isn't it so, like, you know, we have a situation here when I talk to various experts that, you know, sort of government watchdogs that, you know, made a counterpoint, which is to say, okay, fine, you guys get to go out and investigate this stuff. But when, like, the rubber meets the road in terms of law enforcement, mm-hmm. and you got to do, like, an armed raid on someone, why don't you just go to the local police, show up with the local police with your evidence, you know, and or, you know, go to the FBI or some other, like, you know, actual law enforcement agency, understand it, and let them do the actual, you know, heavy lifting, the things that involve firearms, you know. And in some cases, you have these situations where I reported on, like, the EPA went around raiding a bunch of small-town auto shops, essentially, because of various regulations around how emissions are controlled for, quote-unquote, racing vehicles. Like, technically, emission standards aren't supposed to apply for vehicles that are used exclusively for racing. Mm-hmm. But the EPA is basically claiming that anyone does any aftermarket, you know, modifications to their car, you know, involving, I don't know if you know, your audience knows what tuners are, to their engines and stuff like that, and claims they're doing, people are doing these aftermarket modifications and claiming that this is just for, you know, racing vehicles when people are actually driving these on the streets. And so the EPA has been going out and raiding these, like, small town, you know, auto shops. And it's just absolutely crazy the EPA would show up in force armed, you know, in the middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania to raid an auto shop. You know, why not go to the local police? The local police might know the owner of that shop. He might know what, you know, what's going on in the community, whether or not, you know, it's a bad idea, whether or not they can go in to this auto shop with just, you know, a simple warrant and, you know, not a show of force that doesn't intimidate everyone and otherwise keep community relations in a way that doesn't, you know, breed suspicion of the federal government, for instance, which, when you look at what's going on in this country with all the conspiratorial mindset, you know, dialing down the law enforcement as much as possible mm-hmm. while still getting the job done seems to be, like, a prudent way to go about things. And yet, when you look at a lot of these federal raids, I mean, they're just, you know, as heavy-handed as possible. You got, you know, 24 armed federal agents, you know, storming into a small business in a small town for something as trivial as, you know, whether or not they're complying with emission standards. I mean, it's bananas.
Mark, we've read recently about the increased militarization of some local police, even small town police departments with SWAT units or tanks. And generally, it's met with skepticism by many. Do we see some of that sort of bleeding out over into the federal government agencies here, too? If small towns have SWAT teams, maybe the EPA needs a SWAT team, too.
Right. Well, except for the fact that, you know, there have been books written on the militarization of the police.
Yeah.
And it's become almost a cause on the left to talk about, like, what an egregious overreach this is and how poorly trained small town police departments are and how they aren't trained to use, you know, military weapons and all this other stuff that they're being given. And I think there's some validity to that criticism. The problem is like, near as I can tell, all of those same criticisms also apply to the arming of federal agencies that's happened the last 20, 25 years. And no one is really talking about it. Part of that is, I think, just that most people don't realize that this has been happening. The average American clearly has no idea that the Railroad Retirement Board is running around carrying guns.
Or that it even exists.
But, right, exactly. So, I think public awareness would be a first step toward that, and you might get some more criticism of it. On the other hand, we have a situation here where, if you look at how the federal government acts, even under Republican administrations, they're basically the enforcement arm of a lot of progressive policy priorities. So the same people that have been inherently suspicious of local police departments and, you know, BLM and all this other stuff, and where they've really been targeting local police, don't have the incentive to go out and say, oh, the EPA really needs to be reined in because the EPA is fighting climate change. You know, it's a real conflict. And I think that, you know, if we're applying our principles, you know, fairly across the board, those, you know, again, there's been, you know, lots of ink spilled about, you know, the abuse of police and whether or not they deserve to be, you know, militarized, you know, via surplus Pentagon weapons. But those same criticisms should really apply to these federal agencies.
Mark Hemingway, senior writer at Real Clear Investigations. You can find his recent report at realclearinvestigations.com. Follow him on Twitter as well. Mark, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you. Very much. Glad to be here.
Up next, we talk with James Brandon from Hillsdale's Theater Department as we continue our trek through American theater, this time in the 1900s. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio. We're joined by Dr. James Brandon, chairman and professor of theater at Hillsdale College. Dr. Brandon, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here again.
We conclude our three-part series on the history of American theater. Previously, we had a segment on an overview look at theater in America. We spent last time on melodramatic foundations in the 1800s, and this time we talk about drama in the era of film. So how do we see theater adjust, or do we see it adjust as the era of film begins in the United States?
Yeah, I take this part of the course from a book by Xander Briedsky called American Drama in the Age of Film. And so I steal a lot of his ideas when I'm presenting. I mean, we read it together in class. And what he says is, look, when we look at the early history of film and we see the kinds of plays that were being written in the era of film, one of the things that happens is our playwrights, whether they're conscious of it or not, are often writing very cinematically.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, the playwrights have been affected by this new medium, whether or not they're openly acknowledging it. And so we see things that are written in plays that wouldn't and don't necessarily work as well in the live theater setting as they would with a film and with the language of film. And so the class, you know, we look at a number of major American playwrights and we look at the productions of their work and we contrast those with the film versions that were then made out of those works, often with the full support and participation of the playwright. Often the playwrights have at least partial screenwriting credit for these movie adaptations. And it's just fascinating because I can walk into almost any class I teach here, and most, if not all, of the students have an extensive background in film. Live theater, not necessarily, right? So film becomes a great way to open conversations about performance on terms that my students understand implicitly.
So let's start walking through the 1900s, and I think we want to start with a playwright named Eugene O'Neill. Who is he, and why do we need to know about him?
Eugene O'Neill is quite simply the founder of real American drama. There were playwrights before O'Neill, but O'Neill was the first who was really internationally recognized as a kind of treasure. Someone you mention in the same breath as Henrik Ibsen or George Bernard Shaw or August Strindberg. He went through a number of phases as a writer, but he's most well known for his realism and his naturalism. So plays about the world as it is, even when the world as it is isn't very pretty or fun to talk about.
What makes O'Neill the one to break through? What is it about his talent or his writing that allows him to sort of rise above?
I think he was doing things that set the standard. So in the time itself, people recognized his genius. But when you look at the way American drama develops after O'Neill in the next 40 or 50 years, you see that the major playwrights are clearly taking their cue from Eugene O'Neill, right? The two most famous American playwrights of the century, I would argue, are Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller. And it's very clear that they're both very familiar with O'Neill's work. And in fact, I say, you know, a lot of what they are doing is derivative, I think, from what O'Neill was doing. And I don't think in a bad way. I think in the way of homage. I think of in the way that most artists beg, borrow, and steal for ideas from other artists, and they make those ideas their own. And so O'Neill, he's foundational to the way American drama develops over the next century.
We begin our walk through, again, a not exhaustive look at the plays, the most important plays of the century, but some of them, in 1955 with Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Yeah. Oh, a great Tennessee Williams play. And of course, look, I'm limited. I'm using this textbook. And so Britsky's textbook happens to use Cat in a Hat Tin Roof as his example for Tennessee Williams. I would have been happier with Glass Menagerie or Streetcar Named Desire, both, again, great original theater productions and great films. But this is the one he talks about. It's a tough play. It's a realistic play. It's a realistic play about a marriage in distress, about the patriarch of a family who's dying of cancer. It has questions about an heir to the sort of Southern family fortune. And the hope is that Brick and Maggie, who are our protagonists, are going to eventually have children. There's a lot of issues in the play. It's a complex play. It's an emotional play. It's brilliantly acted, both in the film but also the original Broadway production. And it asked a lot of tough questions about who we are as Americans, how we see ourselves, what is our place in the world, what is our place in the family, what is our place as an individual, what makes us an American individual. So we have lots of great, fruitful discussions based on this Tennessee Williams play and film.
Around this point, 1955, and this might change the farther you get into the century, but Are most people who know Cat on a Hot Tin Roof experiencing it first in the theater or on the silver screen?
Always, the answer is always going to be the silver screen, just because, you know, movies are a mass medium. So you do the math, even a 3,000 or 4,000 seat Broadway house over the course of 5 to 10 years, you know, you're going to do that in a weekend on the screen. And, you know, the movie starred Elizabeth Taylor and Paul Newman. And
some star power there.
Yeah, it was a massive movie, although I'm trying to remember. There was some controversy with the movie as well. Tennessee Williams hated a lot of aspects of the movie, and that happens a lot too. Playwrights,
sure,
they're their creative product gets a little bit away from them. And so some changes that Williams made for Broadway that he was okay with had to be sort of doubled down upon for Hollywood, and he wasn't happy with some of the results.
Into the next decade, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf from 1962?
Well, Edward Albee, although I would say that what he's writing is in fact realism and naturalism, is accused, I suppose, of being an absurdist or writing things in a more symbolic style. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is quite simply, I think, the movie version contains the best acting on film in the 20th century. Elizabeth Taylor, again, and Richard Burton are the two leads. It's just a four-person show. The Hollywood version, all four of them were up for the Academy Awards for Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Supporting, Best Supporting. I tell my students, I think there are changes, and one of the things our textbook focuses on is, look, there are things that film does better and differently than theater, and there are things that theater does better and differently than film. And so when we're exploring the differences between the Broadway version and the Hollywood version, we're not always saying, well, you know, Broadway good, Hollywood bad, or vice versa. It's just different. And in this really intimate play, this four-person play, they have to make some changes for a film audience. It's same thing at Cat in a Hot Tin Roof. Cat in a Hot Tin Roof, Maggie and Brick, the entire play takes place in their bedroom. Mm-hmm. They're in a guest room at this mansion. And there's a reason for that. It works really well on stage, but you do that on screen and it's you're wondering, you know, where the door is, right? same thing here Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. It takes place in a single setting. They move all over the place. They move all over the house. It's set on a college campus. They move around the college campus. They even take a drive, none of which is suggested by the play text, but it's a way to tell the story.
Do we see at all playwrights at this time trying to bring in some of elements that work in movies to their plays and vice versa? Do we see filmmakers bringing in things that work in the... I'm just thinking a little bit about Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. Something like Rear Window mm-hmm. is essentially a one-room play. Everything takes place in a room. I think Rope is the same way from yeah. Hitchcock.
Yeah.
Do we see that sort of cross-pollination, so to speak?
No, most films are not trying to be stage plays, right? So they are breaking from the conventions of live theater because they can, because mm-hmm. it's easy to do so. So in a play like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, there's a great sequence. In fact, Breedsky talks about this at length in his book. There's a moment in the play, it's early, it's not a spoiler, but there's a moment in the play where the other three characters are laughing at George, who's one of our protagonists, and he just gets up from the room and walks out of it. And in the theater version, he's gone. And he comes back a few minutes later with a rifle, and he points it at the back of his wife's head, and everybody screams, and he pulls the trigger, and it's a party favorite. An umbrella comes out of the barrel of the rifle, and it's funny. In the film version, we watch Richard Burton stalk away from the conversation and, you know, weave through the house into mm-hmm. the closet. He pulls out this long object that's wrapped and we don't know what it is. And he comes back out and it's all from first person.
Yeah.
We're looking through his eyes, basically. It's a very different kind of experience in the film than it is on the stage. They both work, and they both work in different ways for different reasons. And so there's a way to, you couldn't do that on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a very effective moment in the film, but the way it works on the stage also works. It's just they have to work differently because of our conventions of what we expect to see on the stage as opposed to what we expect to see on the screen.
1984, we move forward to Glengarry Glen Ross.
Well, this is a great one for our Hillsdale audiences and a terrible one for our Hillsdale audiences. I don't think it has the record for F-words, but it's got to be pretty darned close. This is David Mamet. It's arguably his most famous play-movie combo. It's about salesmen. In fact, in many ways, I think this play is a response to Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, one of the most important plays of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
In Mamet's 1980s world, the salesmen are selling real estate, and these are the kind of salesmen who are selling you real estate in Florida, you know, or Arizona,
yes.
that's maybe swamp or desert, but they're in competition with one another. It's very much a very masculine culture, six characters, they're all men, four of them are salesmen, one of them is a mark, you know, a customer, and one of them is the office manager, and you just... you get a sense as to the stakes of what it's like to work in a business like this, where you're living on your wits, mm-hmm. everything's based on commission. And that's, again, one of those things where the stage play has two acts, and the first act takes place in a Chinese restaurant, which is the restaurant across the street from the office. Second act takes place in the office. The film, of course, goes all over the place. And one thing, the film is famous. Alec Baldwin has a part in the film, and it is not in the play.
Right.
And it's one of the more famous monologues of the last 30, 40 years. It's the coffee is for closers monologue. Again, if you have sensitive ears, it's not one you want to listen to. But what Mamet did, and of course Mamet had full exposure on the film. He was working on the film. Full participation, I'm sorry. What Mamet did is he tried to give the audience a sense as to what the stakes were. He thought this would be a great way to show the audience what these guys are up against. Because mm-hmm. when you understand that, it maybe helps us to understand them a bit better and sure. to explain their actions. So it's a brilliant bit of filmmaking. It's not the same as the play. I've worked on the play as a live version. Of course, I've seen the movie many times, and they both work. But again, they work in different ways. And that's really what Breedsky celebrates. He celebrates the idea that American playwrights are so informed by their experience with film mm-hmm. and vice versa. The screenwriters and the actors are often live theater people. And so it's great to sort of see how these things flesh themselves out over the course of the two different genres.
How close to present day do you get in this class? And do you think there are things happening now that will be worthy of discussion 20 years from now?
Oh, sure. I usually try to end the semester with I'm reading a brand new play that's maybe 2 or 3 years old, a play called I and You by a woman named Lauren Gunderson. And Gunderson is probably the most produced playwright in America for the last 5 years running. And so, yeah, I always try to show something very contemporary. We're reading a few plays that, their time, they were written after the textbook. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, if he did an update on the textbook, sure. this would be a great one, right? we study August Wilson, a great African-American playwright, in the class. And when he wrote the book, the only film that had made of his work was a movie called The Piano Lesson, which is great. But a much better work is his play Fences, at least it's my personal favorite. And that was just made into a movie, 5-6 years ago mm-hmm. with Denzel Washington, yeah. and it's a great film. So that would be a great conversation to have. And so there's films like that by other playwrights that aren't covered in the book that we cover.
Dr. James Brandon, chairman and professor of theater at Hillsdale College, walking us through the history of American theater. Dr. Brandon, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you so much.
Up next, we're joined by current Hillsdale student Anna Basols, who's done some digging through the archives in Hillsdale's athletic department. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Coming soon on The Larry Arn Show, psychiatrist, writer, and literary scholar Ian McGilchrist.
You are such an interesting man, living off on an island off Scotland. But I think that your books amount to a campaign to make us use the rest of our brain.
It's very interesting because, of course, I would never think of them as like that, and they're not intended in that way. I am, I suppose, pleased, but I'm very accepting of whatever happens. Generally, I think it's a sensible way to look at life. But I have been noticing that more and more people in more and more areas are referring to my work and finding it relevant. And I'm very pleased by that, as by the response of readers, which is endlessly touching.
Don't miss this conversation between Ian McGilchrist and Hillsdale College president Larry Arn. Subscribe now to The Larry Arn Show at podcast.hillsdale.edu/subscribe. That's podcast.hillsdale.edu/subscribe.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We say hello to all our listeners on KFIR 720 AM in Albany, Oregon. Thank you for tuning in to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're joined now by Anna Basols. She is a junior here at Hillsdale College and an art major, and she, along with a couple of other Hillsdale classmates took a deep dig through Charger athletic history we'll talk about in our conversation today. Anna, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get to the work and what you found, tell us a little about the Museum Studies program that's here at Hillsdale and a little about the Museum Studies class that you took part in.
Yeah, so this the Museum Studies program is really spearheaded by Dr. Stewart. He's also my advisor, and he's great. I really love working with Dr.
Stewart. He's not here. You don't have to say that.
He'd say the same thing. Dr. Stewart hosts the Museum Studies class, and in that class, you actually learn to do a lot of practical skills that are widely transferable, and it's kind of surprising how applicable they are to other areas of business and just working in the public domain generally. You have to figure out how to make the information that you have accessible and fun and kind of translate that to people. So I think that COVID really showed everyone that it can be very difficult to learn online, and it's kind of brought back this interest in museums and public places of education. I think that it's really important that we keep those alive and we have people who know how to run them properly and get the public interested in history.
So this project was kind of an extension on the class, which was this dig through Hillsdale Charger athletic history. You work with a couple of other students, Hope Schlosser and Morris Schmidt, in doing this. What were you looking for? Where did you find it? How did you find the information?
Well, we went in and it was pretty flexible. We didn't know exactly what, we had a lot of free rein in this project. So this thing really is kind of our baby. And we got to be very passionate about this project and work very hard on it and come up with a lot of our own ideas. When we all gathered in the library to talk about things and start doing our research, we thought, well, the best place to start would probably be going through the yearbooks because we need to see what these athletes wore for as far back as we have photos of. So we went through all of the Winona yearbooks, first called the Wolverine, since the late 1800s, and just documented. We made multiple timelines for all the different teams and when they appeared, what they were wearing, and we found some very interesting common themes. And I think that those are reflected in the donations that we got, which we are very fortunate to have gotten.
Yeah, how much of the memorabilia, which we'll talk later, is in these display cases at the athletic complex here on campus, how much was sort of in the college's archives, and how much did you have to reach out to others who were part of these teams back decades ago?
I would say that the majority of it comes from donations from very generous alumni who donated just this summer. I mean, we were only there for 6 weeks, and we were not able to ask for donations until like a couple weeks in when we actually knew what we needed. Mm-hmm. And people responded right away and really just gave up a lot of their stuff for the betterment of the college, which is really cool to see the alumni still connected like that. The college does have quite a bit of really fascinating items in their collection before we got to it. So we took the time to go through a couple storage rooms and archive everything and just document everything and give that all to the college, so they have a pretty comprehensive guide to what they have, roughly when it's from, and potentially who donated it if we could find that out. One of the things that I really liked was the Albion jug, the Hillsdale Albion jug, which was a jug, a big jug, I don't know the name for it, but it was passed from Hillsdale to Albion whenever they would play each other, mm-hmm. because they were rivals back in like the 1930s or so. And Hillsdale won the last game we played with Albion before moving up a division. And so we have the jug, and that's in the display case now.
Talking with Anna Basols about her work researching into the past of Hillsdale Charger athletics, there's this inflection point in 1968 when the nickname for the Hillsdale athletics teams becomes the Chargers. How did that come to be, and what happened after that?
So in 1968, the student body voted to actually become something new. Previously, they had just kind of been referred to as the Dales, and even Coach Muddy Waters would say, you know, what's a Dale? And so the student body, along with faculty, all voted to change, and they really liked the image of a running horse. And from then, the college decided that it would be the Chargers, this kind of war horse, strength and virtue and noble. And that homecoming of 68 was the first time the team played as the Chargers, and they actually brought a live horse onto the field. his name was Hillsdale, and he was from Indiana.
And after the Chargers nickname is adopted by the athletic teams, there's some diffusion in looks and logos and what was every sport essentially doing its own thing at some points?
Yeah, so we jokingly referred to this period as the Cambrian explosion of Chargers. And every team kind of got to design their own thing, so there was a lot of creative interpretations, and some of them are very, very cool, but they weren't very consistent. And it was that way up through the 90s, and there was somewhat more of a coherent symbol in the 2000s, especially around 2008. But with the recession, we weren't able to totally get on the same page with everything, and there was still a lot of variety. But now the rebrand has actually kind of brought all this together, and Mr. Springer has really done a great job giving a nod to the historical context of the Charger and a lot of the iconography that's been used in the past, and incorporating that in his new Charger head.
Yes, if you go to the Hillsdale Athletics website, you'll see the new Charger logo and not new colors, but sort of official colors, I guess, at this point. What do you see in that logo and in the work that you've seen that is sort of expressed through some of the work that you've done? What did you find that you also now see in sort of the new logo going forward?
Yeah, so if you actually look at the mane of the horse, it looks very lightning boltish, which is obviously a reference to Hillsdale's Chargers with the lightning bolt. And the lightning bolt has actually been associated with Hillsdale Athletics since, I think, the earliest reference we could find was somewhere around 1936. And it was actually just on the coaches' sweaters. We don't really know why, but that's kind of when it started to pop up. And then in the early 60s, I think 62 is when we first start to see this, Coach Muddy Waters began putting lightning bolts on the side of Hillsdale helmets in order to dress them up. So it's been definitely a part of our history, and it deserves to be respected and pay homage to that.
A lot of the work that you were able to accomplish, and also Hope and Maura, is now on display at the Hillsdale Athletic Complex here on campus in these display cases as you enter. If you're coming in for a volleyball match or a basketball game, what might people see if they stop by to check out the work that you've done?
Oh, gosh, there are some amazing things in there that I am so excited about. So one of the cases we actually have dedicated to Hillsdale fans, and it explains how we have celebrated our athletics over the years. In the 30s, there were three guys, and they called themselves the Charger Pep Squad. And they were just these goofy three guys that were kind of what the cheerleaders are now, but they were kind of rambunctious. And they would travel with the football team and actually help fundraise for athletics and get all that going. But they would get the crowd really going with cheers, and they would apparently do some stunts. I don't really know, but the college seemed to really love them.
Off the topic of athletics a bit, you also help in some of the exhibits at the Art Museum here on campus too, correct?
I work for Daugherty Gallery, and I absolutely love it there. Professor Kaufman is in charge of that, and she definitely lets us know how it works to run a gallery properly. Right now we have a Jim Gray exhibit in, and this is one of my favorite exhibits that we've ever had. It's just lovely.
So I've got to ask before we let you go, I tell my wife that I'm not a pack rat by any means, but I am an archivist, and so I like to keep things. Are you like this at home?
Oh, goodness. I am a little bit. I have a whole shelf in my dorm room, actually, of a bunch of little knickknacks. I call it my knickknack shelf. And I have rocks from random places that I've traveled. I'll just pick up a pebble and keep it in my pocket and then put it in my knickknack shelf when I get home. And just a lot of little memories there.
Yeah. Anna Basols, a junior here at Hillsdale, an art major who's helped in this project to dig through the Hillsdale Chargers athletic history, along with their classmates Hope Schlosser and Maura Schmidt. And you can see some of the results of their work at the athletic complex here on Hillsdale's campus. Anna, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Adam Carrington, Mark Hemingway, James Brandon, and Anna Basols. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at radiohour.hillsdale.edu or wherever you listen to podcasts. The assistant producer of the show is Nicholas Alfonso. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.